what do you recall as a, you know, maybe a teenager, 15 years old or so, maybe, was there an attraction, awareness about what the early Simon and Garfunkel sound was? Was it intriguing to you? Do you remember it from back then?
Well, yes. In 1965, when I was 15, I was certainly a big Simon and Garfunkel fan. He played acoustic guitar just beautifully, and the licks off of the Simon and Garfunkel records were things that, you know, every acoustic guitar player sort of had to learn, or at least tried to learn, and tried to play with the same kind of aplomb as Paul Simon does, the sweeping little loops in Cloudy. There was a song called Angie, I think, that was strictly an instrumental that, you know, people played a lot. A lot of Paul Simon, you know, a lot of those intros to their hits always had a very cool Paul Simon little guitar lick in the intro that were, you know, one of those things that everybody had to learn. But the thing that I remember most was the fact that he somehow lived... That Simon and Garfunkel, you know, were somehow the bridge between the Beatles and Dylan, and that they were, you know, they had the catchiness of the Beatle melodies, and they had sort of that, you know, acoustic thing that Dylan had. And clearly Paul Simon was influenced a lot by, you know, Northern English folk songs, as was Dylan. So, I mean, there's a lot. They both were influenced by the same thing. It seemed, you know, sort of at the time, even to us at 15 and 16, that Paul Simon was sort of, you know, stuck with Art Garfunkel, his boyhood friend that he had, you know, been, you know, singing songs together and singing his songs and having, you know, Art work with him. And so that, you know, they were a key part of the 1960s. As artists, Simon and Garfunkel, that era of Paul Simon, I think he was really affected by his peers. Well, and so much so that, you know, they had recorded, you know, what, Sounds of Silence, and then, you know, didn't think anything was, you know, going to happen, and then somebody, what, they put bass and drums on it while he was in England, and only because of the fact that, you know, Dylan had sort of started playing with drums, and they said, well, why don't we put drums on this one and see how it works. Oh, working pretty good, sounds like a little like Dylan. And then the follow-up song, what was it, I Am a Rock or something like that, has that Dylan, you know, that song, that track doesn't exist without, you know, Bringing It All Back Home. In other words, Simon wouldn't have gone there unless Dylan did. Let's put it that way. And I think Simon was very, you know, influenced by Beatles, as everybody was, as the Rolling Stones were. I mean, there were a lot of incredible artists at the time who were being led by Bob Dylan and the Beatles. And Simon was one of them. You can listen to the production on any number of the Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel singles, and they're very representative of what just had been a hit for either the Beatles or Bob Dylan.
I think you did, and you had an example in, was it Faking It, that you thought was pretty compelling of that?
I think that, you know, what I'm saying and what I really feel about Paul Simon is that in the 60s, even as a writer, he was somehow influenced by his peers. And one of the main feelings I really remember at the time was that pretty much everybody felt, well, Bob Dylan and the Beatles, they were from another planet. They were untouchable. They were to say, yes, we were flown down from another planet and we are not of the Earth, everybody would have believed it right away, because they didn't seem to be Earth-like. Whereas Paul Simon seemed like a very smart guy who took what these guys were doing, turned it into sort of his own thing, but was being influenced by them. In other words, he was not the innovator. And, you know, a lot of that can be said for the Rolling Stones, too. And many people who were immensely talented who weren't necessarily innovators. I don't think it's a knock on Paul Simon to say he wasn't an innovator. The interesting thing, I think, is that he would become that when both Dylan and the Beatles sort of stepped down. And his solo work, he is innovative. And his solo work, he's no longer listening to contemporary music trying to fit in trying to get a hit by playing to what the sound of the day was. He was much more going his own way on the Paul Simon solo album, first one called Paul Simon, and the second one, There Goes Ryman Simon. And he was now being affected by music that was outside of the pop vein. He was now being, you know, affected by reggae, and me and that's as in Me and Julio or Cecilia, and probably any number of others that I can't think of right this second. But
I think the reggae influence is usually cited in
Mother and Child Reunion. Yes, yes. So now I lost the train a little bit. Let me get back. I'll get it here. That what I'm saying is that as an artist in Simon and Garfunkel, I think he knew he was not the innovator but the follower. And to me, one of the more interesting Paul Simon singles, because one of his gifts is that he's incredibly honest. That's what I think makes a lot of people relate to his lyrics and stuff, and always have. I think he called, he said what I'm saying in the song Fakin' It, which was, I think, amongst the possibly the very last Simon and Garfunkel single. And it opens with an absolute musical rip of Strawberry Fields, to the point that it's not even, you know, it's not even Strawberry Fields like it is Strawberry Fields. And in the song, he says, you know, I've just been faking it, not really making it. And I don't think it makes any of the wonderful songs he wrote in the 1960s any weaker to say he wasn't an innovator. But it's just an interesting difference. I find it's just truly amazing how many hits the man had before he actually started to find his own voice on his first two solo albums with Mother and Child Reunion, and then, you know, Take Me to the Mardi Gras, and the what would become his easy style. He also didn't have much of a voice in the 1960s in terms of a singing voice, and that, I think, changed in the 70s. You know, although he was on the radio along with Bob Dylan and the Beatles, he had a kind of a thin voice, and as soon as you put orchestration over it, it disappears. I mean, it's amazing how they kind of ruined Bridge Over Troubled Water, I think, for posterity, and the Dangling Conversation is kind of ruined with overproduction of strings, and that's not at all the case in any of his 70s stuff. It still sounds wonderful, and he learned how to get it, you know, to double the voice a lot and to make his voice sound thicker. And but he was up against, you know, some astonishing vocalists in Dylan and John and Paul and Ray Davies and others at the time. And he was just sort of average as a singer. And I think he got way better. He just he grew in the 1970s and would again grow in the 80s as an artist, which to me is just, you know, an amazing feat. And I think he was very lucky that he didn't have this body of work in the 60s to live up to. He wasn't exactly the spokesman of the generation, and he didn't have this, you know, incredible pressure to be, you know, a god like the, you know, Lennon and McCartney and Dylan had. And I think it it freed him, whereas it, you know, constricted the others, if that's the right word. Well, the Simon syndrome is what I call the repeating of what he does in his lyrics is repeating lines for reinforcement. Often when he finishes a phrase, he'll repeat the same word at the end of the line. In other words, he'll repeat the same word at the end of the line, which really makes you sort of get it. It's that, whether it's condescending to the American public thinking, tell it to them twice kind of thing. I'm not sure what it is, but it certainly has continued to grow from, you know, you can hear this reinforcement thing on American Tune. I'm just going to name some of my favorite Simon songs, American Tune and St. Judy's Comet and 'Twas a Sunny Day. Virtually at the end of every phrase, but many phrases in those songs, he'll just repeat the last line he said to sort of give it weight as a, you know, lyricist. Say it twice and it's stronger.
Uh-huh. And you feel that's uncommon?
I don't know that it is. Well, it's certainly not common to poetic sort of things. It's his style. It's his calling card is what I'm saying. If you wanted to write a Paul Simon song, yeah, every phrase, yeah, whatever phrase, you know, however you end the phrase, just repeat it again one more time after that. And then you've done your job of seriously mimicking Paul Simon. And it still goes on. I mean, it's almost like Tourette syndrome on Surprise on his most recent album. He can't stop. It's like a tick or a twitch. That's his thing. There's so many of his wonderful songs. In the 60s, in Simon and Garfunkel, the two greatest Simon and Garfunkel songs, I think, are The Boxer and America. All right. One thought I'd like to add, Paul, is that with Paul Simon's vocals in Simon and Garfunkel, that when I'm listening to them now, what I hear is sort of that mighty wind thing from the Chris Guest movie that in some way sort of, you know, mocked the earnestness of folk singers. And I hear Paul Simon being, you know, unbelievably earnest when he's singing. And now I will try to cite some places. Let's stop. Yes, that earnestness that you can hear in Richard Corey and you can hear in A Most Peculiar Man. It even goes, you know, pretty much through into Bookends and stuff, and even Hazy Shade of Winter. There's this sort of clipped, you know, thing going on that's affected and stuff. He was, I believe, searching for his voice in the 1960s, and what would happen, I think, is that he just sort of relaxed. And his vocal style became more conversational, is how I would put it. Another point to add here. let's try that again. Another point to add here is just how good an acoustic guitar player Paul Simon was. He does not get the run for this, and he should. He was tremendously machine-like, yet had a tremendous style and flow to what he played.